Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an appeal for social justice from the nuns on the bus who are touring the richest country on earth that is casting aside more and more of its citizens. Sister Simone Campbell, the director of Network, joins us to discuss her visit to the district offices of Congressman Paul Ryan, whose budget gives more tax cuts to the wealthy and more money for defense while dramatically cutting Social Security, health and education funding, and aid to the hungry and poor. Then, as Mitt Romney prepares for a weekend retreat of campaign strategy and money-raising sessions in Deer Valley, Utah, where he'll be hosting his top billionaire donors, Karl Rove, the vice presidential hopefuls, and a pantheon of Republican heavy hitters and conservative commentators, we will hear from Craig Holman, who is the Government Affairs Legislative Representative for Public Citizen. We will discuss the fiction that super PACs such as Karl Rove's do not coordinate with the Romney campaign. Then finally, we'll speak with award-winning documentary filmmaker Eugene Jarecki about his latest film, The House I Live In. This powerful and personal film tells the complete and untold story of the failed war on drugs and its costs to American society from the perspective of the victims as well as the prosecutors, narcotics detectives, federal judges, and prison officials trapped in this trillion-dollar failure that has jailed 45 million Americans. Let's now join the nuns on the bus. Joining us now is Sister Simone Campbell, the Executive Director of Network, a Catholic social justice lobby. She was recently singled out for criticism by the Pope for what the Vatican believes to be the promoting of radical feminist themes incompatible with the Catholic faith. She is now traveling with the Nuns on the Bus tour through the Midwest swing states. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sister Simone Campbell.
It's an honor to be with you.
And how are you enjoying the tour of the Midwest? I take it yesterday you were in Janesville, Wisconsin, visiting the office of House Republican Paul Ryan.
That's correct. We had an amazing visit there. I am totally stunned at the huge turnout that of people who are coming here, a word of hope to be. I mean, people are being touched by what we're doing, and then they tell me their stories. We were just with a woman who told me about that she, on June 12th, she got notice that her medical care is being cut off, and she's a disabled person. We've had people tell us about how their son, disabled son is not going to be able to get care if the Ryan budget goes forward. I mean, story after story, I come back to the bus and just cry. This is not our nation. This is not the best of who we are, and there's an alternative. That's what people don't know. There's another way. Is the faithful budget, which if we have reasonable revenue for responsible programs, we can get out of this. There's alternatives. We've got to make other choices. It's breaking my heart.
So have you been able to get this message to Paul Ryan? I'm not entirely sure that he meets with people that are poor and disadvantaged. And, of course, you had dinner with the poor and homeless people at a church nearby. What's your understanding of what he understands about the kind of stories that you're hearing from people in this country who are being hurt by his policies?
Well, I don't know what he hears. It doesn't seem to me that he's heard these stories, because anybody who's got a heart at all would weep with the story. He wants to think more often that, you know, people are dependent, people are weak, we can't allow this weakness. This is a lie. People who live at the economic margins are working really hard all the time to hold life together. I just met this guy, Chris, who was left at the... at a hospice situation where he couldn't even do anything for himself. He was paralyzed, and then they cut off his medical care. They cut off his medical care. Who could do that? I ask you. What's going on in our nation that this happens? This is wrong. So I asked Paul Ryan to come walk with us just for a little bit. He's wrong that we have to cut these things off, that we have to make this false choice that we don't have enough money to care for people. It's a question of political will. It's a simple thing. Let the tax cut expire. Let's go back to where we had a surplus in 2000. Let's restore our nation. This is outrageous.
Well, of course, Sister Simone, at any moment, the Supreme Court will do exactly what you're alarmed by the prospect of. They may well eviscerate President Obama's Affordable Care Act.
I know. I'm worried. But I'm trustful that we as a nation have shifted far enough to look for quality of care. We as a nation will not go back to, you know, cutting people off just because they've had an illness. It's ridiculous. We as a nation have got to stand up and say that everybody has a right to health care. It was a step forward in the Affordable Care Act, and I'm trusting that the Supreme Court, who is trusted with caring for our nation, will do what's right for our nation, not just what's right for politics or right for the pocketbook. We as a nation need to pull together.
And Sister Simone Campbell, again, traveling with the nuns on the bus tour through the Midwest swing states. We out here in California, of course, don't know that there's an election going on because of this peculiar business of, even though they're raising billions of dollars on both sides, they only spend this money in the swing states. And yes, you're there in the swing states, so I imagine you're
right,
seeing...
We're kind of a low-budget operation. I can't hand out a bunch of flyers. I've got a copy of the paper budget, but I only brought enough for each of the congressional offices because I had no idea what was going to happen. So, you can't find money, but the fact is we've got values, we've got faith, and we've got people on our side. What more can you do?
Well,
the spirit is alive.
Well, if you had only a fraction of the kind of money that's being spent. In fact, the people that you're talking about who are desperately in need, think of the money that is being spent to persuade America to vote against its own interests.
I know. And can I just quickly tell you one story of a woman at our last stop? She's on SSI, which is for the really poor elderly. She lives in a housing project with other SSI-receiving elderly. She took up a collection to support us and gave us $20 from these people to help support our trip. I am so humbled and so honored because everybody wants to contribute to our society, but this is breaking my heart.
So this is a 9-state tour. I mean, this is going to be the tough road ahead. If this is you're just the beginning,
yeah,
you're going to be a wreck by the end of it.
I know, lots of cleaner. That's it. But I'll tell you that each morning we do prayer together, and that's really what sustains us. When you look at, okay, here my heart's broken. Oh, but that's just a broken heart. Hey, it opens me up to these people. But how could I not do this in the face of their suffering? I mean, when they're worried about food, a guy we met yesterday at St. Benedict, he brings his family there because he can only make the choice between a house, you know, roof over their head, or food. And so he chose a roof over their head rather than living in their car.
So do you think, though, Sister Simone, that there's a way to not just get the message out that you're giving us and our audience now, but the people who are the victims of this economy and of this kind of cruel sort of social Darwinism that the Ryan budget wants to impose on America and cut what's little of our very frayed social safety net.
Yeah.
Do you think that the victims, the people, and the potential victims of this are going to wake up and organize and vote? I mean, that's one of the problems, I understand, is that the more you beat people down, the less politically active they become.
Right. Well, I'm holding out some hope that this tour seems to be stirring something up. I met with some Hispanic folks that are trying to organize a labor union at a production place, and this is their first time of trying to exercise their voice, and that as exercising their voice, I think they're finding that it's possible to be done, and that maybe they can encourage the folks moving forward that we can do this together. It's my hope. The other piece is that the big money, you can feel like David and Goliath, but if you read the scriptures, you know that we might not win every battle, but we can win some significant ones. So in a nonviolent way, of course, but we really are trying to lift up folks' voice, energy, commitment, and move forward. It's an honor to be doing this work.
Well, and it seems that that your problems with the Vatican may be sort of, obviously, at this point, they're not your priority. But I've noticed...
No. Hey, we got to make this straight. We're standing with our bishops on this one. There's unity on this one. It's a great opportunity to build bridges and try to find ways forward. So,
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Sister Simone Campbell, the Executive Director of Network, a Catholic social justice lobby. She was recently singled out for criticism by the Pope for what the Vatican believes to be the promoting of radical feminist themes incompatible with the Catholic faith, specifically Network's ties to the Leadership Conference of Women Religious and its support for President Obama's healthcare reform push, as well as its perceived failure to promote church teaching on abortion, contraception, homosexuality, and the male-only priesthood. She is traveling with the nuns on the bus tour through the Midwest swing states. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the fiction that super PACs like Karl Rove do not coordinate with the Romney campaign.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning. I'd hammer in the evening, all over this land. I'd hammer out justice. Then I'd hammer out freedom. I'd hammer out love between my brothers and sisters. Oh.
Tax collectors getting closer, still we have fun. There's nothing surer, the rich get rich and the poor get poorer. In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun? Don't we have fun?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Craig Holman, the Government Affairs Legislative Representative for Public Citizen, where he works on Capitol Hill on campaign finance and governmental ethics. Previously, he was Senior Policy Analyst at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Holman.
Good to be here, Ian.
And tell me, Craig, about I think it was a Fourth Circuit court. I'm not sure which federal court has now ruled against American Crossroads political strategies or Crossroads GPS to make their donor list public. And I believe the White House has weighed in as well. Where does it stand?
At this point, the lower court ruling still stands, but it's being appealed. So quite frankly, we're probably not going to have a resolution, a full resolution of this until after the election. However, right now, at this point, the lower court ruling still stands. There hasn't been any kind of, injunction against the lower court ruling. So if Crossroads GPS or the Chamber of Commerce or other groups decide to do electioneering communications, which means ads within 60 days of the election that don't actually say vote for or vote against, but they discuss candidates and target that candidate's constituency, they are subject to the disclosure requirements. They'd have to disclose their donors. What we're seeing happen is most of these groups have then stopped their electioneering communications and are switching to what remains still secret forms of advertising, and that's, believe it or not, express advocacy. If they do flat-out campaign ads that say vote for, vote against, elect, they can do that still, pay for that with their corporate sponsors, and not have to disclose the donors. So that's the status. We're seeing a number of these groups switching from electioneering communications to direct express advocacy ads. So even though the ruling is great, it really hasn't caused much of a bump when it comes to the spending in the 2012 campaigns, the secretive corporate slush fund spending in the 2012 campaigns.
So does that mean then that the 501c4s, is that what you're saying, that they're untouched and that the others, the more open ones that have to reveal their donors, they're only subject to any sanction if they do direct electioneering? I'm trying to understand how bad this situation is, because what you just told me suggests that it's out of control.
Well, it's absolutely out of control, but the distinguishing factor between what has to be disclosed or who has to disclose what depends on the type of the campaign ad they run. You know, if they're a 501c4 or even a super PAC for that matter, if they run that type of electioneering communications, right now the lower court ruling stands that they have to disclose their donors. If they do the more express advocacy, vote for, vote against, elect, they don't have to disclose their donors. So really the distinguishing feature largely is the type of campaign ad that they run. And by the way, I want to point out, I mean, it's a very easy shift for all these groups. The Chamber of Commerce has traditionally preferred to do electioneering communications rather than, say, vote for a certain candidate, because they've always claimed that, you know, they're just doing issue advocacy and they're not really doing electioneering. Well, it doesn't take any amount of work to change those electioneering communication ads and add the word vote for in it and run them as a direct campaign ad. And that's exactly what the Chamber of Commerce has decided to do. It's an easy shift for them to make, but it's interesting because it really exposes the Chamber for what they've always been doing all along, and that is running campaign ads.
Well, Craig Holman, these issue ads that they do, that they don't expressly tell you who to vote for, but they tell you everything else, and you'd have to be incredibly politically naive or even, you know, brain dead not to notice who they're really advocating for. So as far as I can see, the barn door's open and the horse is way down the paddock on that one. But what's interesting here is that this coming weekend, candidate Romney is having this big posh weekend donors retreat that's going to feature Karl Rove and many of the vice presidential hopefuls, along with Condoleezza Rice and James Baker, Mary Matlin, Bill Kristol, Fred Barnes, and of course all of the big Republican Party donors are going to be there to talk strategy. The New York Jets owner Woody Johnson, who's the chairman of Romney's New York finance operation, calls the retreat very, very important for the campaign. So if Karl Rove is showing up to hang out for the weekend in a Utah resort with the candidate, isn't that crossing the line? I mean, I don't understand how they can maintain this fiction of super PACs saying that they're not directly affiliated with the campaign.
One would think that would cross the line, wouldn't you? Ian, you point out another huge mythology we have going on when it comes to our campaign finance laws in 2012. These outside groups, super PACs and the 501Cs that are spending on campaigns, are technically allowed to spend unlimited amounts of money supporting or opposing candidates as long as they don't coordinate with the campaigns. The problem is the definition of coordination. First of all, we're leaving it up to the Federal Election Commission, which is the agency that defines coordination, and they've come up with an extremely narrow definition in which it would actually have to involve mutual discussions between the candidate and the outside group, where the candidate is essentially instructing the outside group where to run campaign ads and what to say. An extremely narrow definition. That isn't how any of these outside groups operate. What they do is they bring in the former staff of the campaign, and the staff who understands where things have to, where the campaign ads are supposed to run and what they're supposed to say, and they share vendors. Political ad buyers who buy the campaign ads will be the same people buying the campaign ads for the campaign for Mitt Romney as for Karl Rove's Crossroads group and the outside group. So all this coordination is done very easily and almost very, you know, in the open. I mean, you're talking about this fundraising event where Romney's going to be sitting around explaining what his campaign is going to do, and you're going to have Karl Rove sitting there taking notes. You know, Karl Rove's going to say he was never instructed by Romney to you know, run a certain campaign ad in a certain state, but he's going to sit there and take notes as to where the competitive states are and what the message is supposed to be. I mean, this is coordination by any other name. It's just the Federal Election Commission won't call it that. And then what makes things even more difficult, Ian, is the Federal Election Commission is an agency that has three Democrats and three Republicans sitting on it. And the Republicans, under the leader of Commissioner Don McGahn, really don't believe in the campaign finance law. And so they consistently vote their block of three commissioners against enforcing the law when there is obvious violations of the coordination rules. Without a four-vote majority, no decision can be made by the FEC. So as a result, we've seen FEC deadlocks just stymie the enforcement of the laws. So even if we did have a clear definition of coordination, this election agency won't enforce it anyway.
Again, I'm speaking with Craig Holman, the Government Affairs Legislative Representative for Public Citizen, where he works on Capitol Hill on campaign finance and governmental ethics. And we're talking about this big retreat that candidate Romney has coming up this weekend, starting on Friday in Deer Valley, Utah. It's a homecoming for the candidate Romney, and his top aides, of course, will be there along with all of his advisors. It'll be coordinated by Mike Leavitt, the Utah governor, who has been tapped as Romney's head of his transition team to the White House. And it's been touted by the campaign as a retreat, as a way to reward the top performing bundlers. And they've, outraised Obama, $76.8 million in May to $60 million for Obama. And the whole purpose of this meeting is to obviously coordinate the campaign with the money that's pouring in. So it's not just Karl Rove who's crossing the line here by having this fictional disconnect between the candidate and the super PAC that he runs. This is a meeting of all of the heavy hitters, all of whom are giving to super PACs. So this is a bigger fiction. But you're saying that even though they'll be breaking the law, there's nothing you can do about it because the Republicans on the FEC will block any enforcement of the law.
That's right. We're not going to see enforcement, even if there is obvious coordination going on. The votes of the Federal Election Commission, ever since Don McGahn was appointed essentially by Senator Mitch McConnell, who does not believe in campaign finance laws, once he appointed Don McGahn onto the commission, the number of deadlock votes have increased eightfold. Literally, Don McGahn has effectively shut down the elections agency when it comes to the campaign cop on the beat here. We no longer have anyone monitoring and enforcing the law. And people like Karl Rove, Adelson, and others fully realize that we've just entered the unregulated Wild West of money and politics. And they could pretty much do anything they want to at this point.
Well, it looks like this whole weekend is a great opportunity for them to really coordinate. You've got all of the big donors. You've got all of the strategists like Karl Rove. You've got all of the big heavy hitters in the Republican Party like Condoleezza Rice, Jeb Bush, Jim Baker. And then you've got all of the propagandists like Mary Matlin and Bill Kristol. And then, of course, on top of that, you've got all of the potential vice presidential candidates for Romney there as well. So this feels like the big donors, starting on Friday with their dinners and Saturday night with more dinners and dancing on Saturday evening, and then festivities continue through Sunday with golf. It sounds like there'll be ample opportunity for all of the above to coordinate. And I'm just... I'm
without
stunned.
Missing terms, Ian, that's exactly what this meeting is all about. It's to make sure that all the big money players in the 2012 elections that are supporting Romney know exactly what each other is doing, know exactly where the money is needed, know exactly what the message is all about. This is to get everybody on the same page to, take on Obama and the Democrats in Congress in the 2012 elections. You know, just to highlight how closely coordinated. All these groups are, you know, if you take a look at some of the outside groups, you've got Crossroads. Karl Rove originally set up Crossroads as American Crossroads, a super PAC. The super PAC, as a registered political action committee, actually has to disclose its donors. And so he noticed he was pulling in some big money from wealthy individuals, corporate moguls, but he wasn't getting the corporate money. So he set up Crossroads GPS as a 501c that doesn't have to disclose any money that they get, and that's where all the corporations are pumping their money. Crossroads GPS has become the major fundraiser of the whole Crossroads entity. Just last year, it raised about $77 million compared to $46 million by American Crossroads. And then these Crossroads groups have the same post office address as Norm Coleman's American Action Network. They've got the exact same post office address. They hire Michael Lubke, who used to run Americans for Job Security, another one of these electioneering outside groups, to do their ad placements for all these entities together: American Action Network, Crossroads GPS, American Crossroads. And Michael Lubke is also hired by the Republican Party to place ads for the Republican Party. I mean, this is how closely intertwined these networks are. To view them as independent expenditures and outside groups is a complete myth. This is a highly coordinated insider ball game going on here, paid for largely by billionaires and millionaires.
And American corporations who are able to hide from their consumers their political bias. You know, their Target got into trouble up in Wisconsin for supporting some right-wing candidate, and they quickly distanced themselves from that. So American corporations are concerned that they've got half of their customers are Democrats and half of them Republicans, and they don't want to offend one half or the other. But if these corporate CEOs are able to secretly give money to the Republicans, then they're off the hook.
That's right. Just to clarify the technical differences between the two types of outside groups. You know, one is super PACs like American Crossroads, and since they have to register with the Federal Election Commission as a PAC, they do disclose their donors. So that's not where you see the corporate money go. Instead, that's where literally the billionaires who don't mind their name being used in these identified with supporting a certain candidate go. The corporations go to the 501c's. And then, you know, an easy trick, by the way, for a corporation like a Wall Street bank to launder its money is it puts it in a 501c, such as a Crossroads GPS, which is a 501c, and then Crossroads GPS will make a contribution to American Crossroads, the super PAC. So when the super PAC discloses its donors, we no longer know that the money came from any particular bank or company. Instead, all we know is it came from Crossroads GPS. So the money essentially has become invisible in American politics. And, you know, just to give you some numbers, after we passed the McCain-Feingold law out here in 2002, we set up a system of full disclosure of where all the money's coming from. We literally had 100% disclosure of donors in 2004, 2006. Immediately following the Citizens United decision, that fell to 50% in 2010. And now corporations are very, very familiar with how they can hide their money. And so we're going into the 2012 election with a much, much lower rate of disclosure. Literally, this is an election where we've gone full circle back to the robber baron eras when corporate secret slush funds are what's being used to buy our politicians.
Again, I'm speaking with Craig Holman, the Government Affairs Legislative Representative for Public Citizen, where he works on Capitol Hill on campaign finance and government ethics. Now, why is the White House then joining in to force this court judgment against Karl Rove and Crossroads. They obviously don't have any weight in this. I mean, if it all comes down to the fact that the courts are already ruled that they have to disclose their donors, and they've appealed it, so they're refusing to, because of the appeal, they're refusing to release the donors. So what's the point of the White House there? Is that just they're just trying to score political points, or is there any way that there can be any enforcement?
The complaints with the Federal Election Commission, by the way, follows on the heels of an identical complaint that a public citizen filed with the Federal Election Commission. And this complaint was filed by the Obama campaign, not the White House itself. It was filed by the Obama campaign. And the purpose of it is to highlight the fact that all these groups are evading disclosure. I know the Obama campaign, just like Public Citizen, does not expect this Federal Election Commission, under the leadership of Don McGahn, to suddenly say, okay, we now realize that we're not carrying through with our mission to implement the campaign finance law and disclose all the donors, and so we've changed our mind. I don't expect that to happen. I'm sure Obama does not expect that to happen. What we are all trying to do is make sure every American understands what's going on in this campaign. I mean, we are going to be inundated with television ads and radio ads, especially as we get within the couple months of the election. And we're not going to know who's paying for all this. It's important that every American voter know that the campaign finance law is being widely evaded everywhere, and that most of this money is very likely coming from the corporations that have most at stake. And those corporations are the industries that have been subject to regulation recently. In other words, Wall Street, the healthcare industry, and the oil industry as well.
Well, just in closing, Greg Holman, just to clarify some of this, because I think there's some confusion in the public about Citizens United being responsible for all of these super PACs. They're not really, are they? There were two other rulings that have been equally damaging that haven't gotten much attention. The Arizona ruling by the Supreme Court striking down an Arizona law that did level the playing field in terms of money for candidates. And then there's a lower court ruling that has opened up the field for super PACs and the 501c4s, right?
Yes, you're talking about the speechnow.org ruling, but I want to clarify that those rulings are, especially the speechnow.org, is directly tied to the Citizens United. It was a lower court in speechnow.org that was saying, well, since the Supreme Court ruled in Citizens United that outside spending poses no danger of corruption, we're therefore going to strike down any contribution limits to outside money. And it was based entirely on Citizens United. Make no mistake about it. Citizens United has set the entire tone for the collapse of reasonable limits on money in politics and the collapse of disclosure of money that's behind all the campaign ads. Let's put blame where it's due, and it's due on those five justices in the Citizens United case.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Craig Holman.
It was a pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Craig Holman, the Government Affairs Legislative Representative for Public Citizen, where he works on Capitol Hill on campaign finance and governmental ethics. Previously, he was Senior Policy Analyst at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with award-winning documentary filmmaker Eugene Jarecki talking about his latest film, The House I Live In.
All gone eventually, trooping out of state for a plate. Knowledge, if coke was cooked without the garbage, we'd all have the top dollars. Imagine everybody flashing, fashion, designer clothes, lacing your click up with diamond rolls. Your people's holding dough, no parole, no rubbers. Going raw, imagine law with no undercovers. Just some thoughts for the mind. I take a glimpse into time, watch the blend read, the world is mine.
If I rule the world,
imagine that.
I free all my sons.
I'm on the board.
border of Bolivia, working for pennies, treated like a slave. The coca fields have to be ready. The spirit of my people is starving, broken and sweaty, dreaming about revolution, looking at my machete. But the workload is too heavy to rise up in arms, and if I ran away, I know they'd probably murder my moms.
Okay, listen, Juan Valdez, just get me my product before we chop off your hands for workers' misconduct. I got the power to shoot a copper and not get charged, and it would be sad to see your family in front of a firing squad. So the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Eugene Jarecki, who is an award-winning director of a number of feature documentaries, including Reagan, Freakonomics, Why We Fight, The Trials of Henry Kissinger. And his latest documentary feature is The House I Live In, which premieres at the LA Film Festival on Friday and opens nationwide in October. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eugene Jarecki.
Thanks for having me very much.
The G20 world leaders just completed a meeting in Mexico, and of course Mexico has become essentially poised to be a failed state because of the war on drugs. 60,000 Mexicans have died, but there's an extraordinary kind of disconnect. There's organized crime south of the border, but when the drugs move into America, it's as though we live in this immaculate country where we have no crime, and somehow we're not responsible, where we are the demand for these drugs, and we also, of course, are where the weapons that the cartels use to kill each other are bought.
Right.
The war on drugs is so destructive to Mexico, and how have we managed to psychologically dodge that bullet?
Well, my film focuses very heavily on the domestic war on drugs and its history as a phenomenon of both law enforcement, criminal justice professionals, and ultimately of a prison industrial system that I believe has lost its way and that many people involved in it see as misguided and having ultimately lost sight of its, sort of come unmoored from its original purpose. Having said that, there is no question that one of the things my film briefly alludes to, but would have to be a completely other film to even begin to scratch the surface of, is the larger international implications of the war on drugs. It is despairing enough and destructive enough what we do here within our own borders to then contemplate what the ripple effect of our demand for drugs, but not only our demand, but our system of dealing with that demand as a crime and therefore elevating the price tag of it. We don't reduce our demand as a society. We criminalize it and have made an internal sort of cottage industry out of the policing of it, and by so doing have raised the price, raised the attractiveness, and therefore created an incredible engine for the sort of destruction that we're seeing in Mexico and elsewhere. That is a larger story, and it's probably the sequel I need to make of this film, because what I wanted Americans to understand first and foremost was that in their own backyard, it's heartbreaking. All around them, to people they know, it is eroding their lives. To people they don't know, it is eroding their lives. To the people involved in it, you know, there are the direct victims of the war on drugs who receive these draconian sentences and have their lives upended by them. But then there are all the people who have to mete out these laws, the people in law enforcement and criminal justice, corrections officers, who ultimately have to work under a system that they didn't design that ultimately is erosive of their soul. Why? Because it's not progressing anyone. They see the same people revolving through the system. They arrest somebody on a Monday and see them back out on the street 10 days later, unchanged, unhelped, having gone through some system that ultimately spits them back out and does not improve society's broader handling of drugs as a social issue. And you see this at all levels. Judges in America feel that their hands are tied. Judge after judge that I spoke to feel that ultimately the way the drug laws have been written create mandatory sentences that give them, the judges, no power to decide what a person coming before them should get, that they're basically rubber stamping a set of laws that Congress put in place with assigned penalties that are sight unseen. One judge said to me that the young man he was sentencing before me, he said, that young man, if he had won the Medal of Honor yesterday, I could not take it into account in sentencing him today.
Well, one of the people in your documentary, Eugene Jarecki, The House I Live In, makes the point that there are more people who have been made slaves of the war on drugs by the prison system and the parole system and the judicial system than were real slaves in the 1850s before the Civil War.
Sure, that if you add up the numbers today of people who are either in prison or jail or on parole or in one part or another of the criminal justice system, awaiting trial or having served time and now being under the control of the criminal justice system, that number significantly outweighs the maximum number of slaves that were enslaved a decade before the Civil War. That's a fact from Michelle Alexander's remarkable book, The New Jim Crow, in which Ms. Alexander also studies the same phenomenon that she is an African-American woman and social scientist perceived. She's also a lawyer and focuses on civil rights, that what she was seeing is very much what I came to see through my film. And what I tried to do was not just to trace this personal aspect of it with myself. That actually only occupies a very small amount of time in the movie because it's really just my bridge into the issue. The issue itself then takes over. And what I found were stories all across America at all levels of the criminal justice system, from the addict all the way up to the senator, meaning an entire kind of perceived hierarchy between those at the bottom who are suffering from drugs and then those who are suffering as well from the way drugs are treated by the criminal justice system, all the way through the jailers and the wardens and the police and the prosecutors and the defense lawyers and the judges. We tried to talk to so many people whose lives are interwoven with the war on drugs who really know firsthand, far better than any, you know, outspoken critic could. They know firsthand where the ravages, the wages of this system really lie. And so many of them don't think the system makes sense. And with a remarkably inspiring spirit for me, a lot of them speak out very candidly about it in the film and spoke to me personally in a way that I wanted to share with audiences, because I think a lot of them will surprise viewers who see the film in that they're not just sort of good Germans who operate the machine and have nothing to say about it. They're a unique breed of people who work, for example, in criminal justice, in corrections, in law enforcement. These are, in many cases, very hardworking, very, very caring people who do a job they ultimately did not design. They don't entirely see the sense in it. They find the laws overly draconian and misguided. And yet they try to do their best within that grip. And that's been fascinating to see. And, of course, it adds a great deal of inspiration to the film for viewers who want to do something about this, to see, you know, one of the most remarkable characters in the film is a security chief at an Oklahoma prison named Mike Carpenter, who became a real force in the film. And he does, because when you first see him, you think he's just a sort of a blueprint for a tough-as-nails prison guard. But really what he is a very deep-thinking person who is on the receiving end of all of the human beings incarcerated under a system of laws that he and many like him do not think makes sense, that punish the nonviolent at times, for example, far more severely than the violent.
One of the things that I found extraordinary about the film, and it's very gritty in terms of the street scenes, and you contrast people dealing on the streets with the kind of the sanitary emptiness of prisons and corridors and jails and the whole kind of mechanism of processing these human bodies through this dysfunctional system. But the film points out, in a very deep historical way, that really race has always been the driver for the war on drugs. There's been several episodes in the war on drugs, starting in California in the last century, in the 19th century, with the fear of the Chinese taking jobs from the whites and the Chinese anti-Chinese purges. They were justified on the basis of opium addiction, even though largely white people were addicted and it was free and available across the counter. Then you also have how cocaine was very popular and open across the counter, particularly in the South with women, white women, and then it then became the galvanizing force behind a war on drugs on the basis that black men were cocaine addicts, and then the same with marijuana being associated with Latinos.
Well, what happens is that the war on drugs, as my film unpacks it, did begin in race, there's no question, and we see chapter by chapter drug laws used really as a thin veil over what were really sort of racial control policies, a technique for being able to single out one race or another at a given time in our history, when for one reason or another the society, the larger society, the those in power saw it as convenient or politically necessary or politically effective to single out those people for a particular brand of harassment. And so you see, yes, what happened with the Chinese in the 1800s then passes to African Americans at the turn of the 20th century. Sort of newly freed slaves are now a threat to both the white workforce and also a perceived threat in their potential impact on white women, et cetera. And so cocaine becomes the sort of drug associated with the black male. And then the next is Mexicans, where we see hemp become marijuana, with a sort of Mexicanization of that word being a signal in and of itself of the way in which Mexican Americans were then targeted. It was sort of seen as a Mexican drug and was stigmatized. Well, what we see that happened throughout time, and of course the latest incarnation that brought us to the present, was the crack scare of the 1980s, where the stories about crack became hyperbolic and really propagandistic, and interwoven always was sort of the stereotype of the black crack addict, whether it was Reagan and his sort of crack den mother kind of figures, these welfare queens and crack-addicted mothers. Much of that was overblown. There's no question crack, like many drugs that people can take, can be abused and can deeply impact and very negatively impact the user. And there's no question that over the years relating to crack, we have seen the emergence of street violence and things like that associated with crack. But more often than not, those things are as much a product of the drug war conducted against crack as anything in the chemical. People should know that crack is the same chemically as powder. It is the same drug, only a little bit diluted by water and baking soda. And you then heat it on a stove. These are instructions I don't think anyone needs to follow, but they're helpful to understand that crack and powder, being made of the same chemical, one would think, for example, would have the same penalty. But you see the racism emerge in the fine print of these laws, because what some people may know and others not is that crack has historically been punished 100 times more severely than powder. Same chemical, 100 times the penalty. And of course, if at the time you're letting it be known that crack, the cheaper drug, is attractive, therefore, to the poorer black user than it is to the typically more well-off white user of powder cocaine, that means that if I myself and a black person are walking down the street and one happens to have crack on them and one has powder, I would need, carrying powder, 100 times as much drugs on me as my counterpart to get the same penalty. And that, of course, created an incredible inequity in who was being sent to jail, let alone that blacks were being policed far more aggressively, that poverty in the black community caused the use and sale of drugs to be far more on the street than in the white community, where it was more private. And so we saw an incredible disproportion explode the walls of our prison system and fill it with a disproportion of African Americans that defies any gulag in the world. It's heart-wrenching. And so the film moves through this racial tragedy that has had many chapters. But what we ultimately find, and we can talk about this if you want, is that the movie moves ultimately from race to class. As more Americans become poor across racial lines, and as a lot of the old myths about what races are using what fall away, what we see is a poor population across the board being targeted by law enforcement very often, and ultimately being targeted by the criminal justice system very often in ways that are far more severe than one would see them treated if it were a violent crime.
And of course, there's a parallel scourge in the white community of so-called hillbilly heroin, which is methamphetamine. But the fact, nevertheless, is stark and disturbing, is that of the 2 million people in prison in the United States, and of course we have the dubious distinction of having more people in prison than communist China, Iran, all of the oppressive countries in the world, just about combined. And of the 2 million in jail, 1 million are black men.
That's true. And what you see in this entire picture, and I want to talk about this with respect to California for a moment, because one of the things my film is trying to do is to make itself available for people fighting against the ongoing injustices of the war on drugs across the country. And so we try to make the film available in areas where there are laws or practices under review that could be vulnerable to a measure of reform. We see in California, for example, that California, has for decades now had the three strikes and you're out law. And the three strikes law, which is famous across the country now, is the most draconian in the country, in that a person in California can get a life sentence for a third strike that is petty or nonviolent. So of the 8,000 people who have life sentences in California, About 5,000 of them were put in jail for life for a nonviolent or petty third offense. Take an example. One gentleman is in jail for stealing a slice of pizza in Redondo Beach. That constituted a life sentence because it was a third strike. Another with a similar predicament was stealing denture cream. That denture cream theft created a life sentence for that person. One of the things we're trying to do is to support an initiative that's coming out in November on the ballot that would make this much more sensitive to common sense. It would basically say that the third strike would have to be serious or violent to give somebody a life sentence. There would be about 3,500 people in jail right now who were put in jail for nonviolent reasons who would thus not have life sentences. Their sentences would be mitigated in that sense. That's a very important piece of potential reform that Californians should know about, because the war on drugs is vulnerable across the country. The extreme measures that we have gone to and the extreme damage that we've done to our population over the past decades, and it is spreading now outside of the black community into poor white communities, Latino communities, and everywhere where, frankly, everywhere where this predatory system can consume human beings, it will go. And we need to put proper and measured common sense brakes on it. And this kind of reform, which is happening in other states as well, in New York, you see that the governor of New York and the mayor of New York City have both come down on the practices of the NYPD in what's called stop and frisk, where about 700,000 New Yorkers are stopped every year and half of them are subject to being frisked. And only a tenth of those actually lead to an arrest. In other words, in only a tenth of those cases was there actually even a point to doing the arrests. And when that happens, it's for a nonviolent offense. So all that fishing expedition to ultimately arrest a bunch of young black and Latino people, most often for having marijuana in their pocket, where in New York it's not a crime. It's only a crime when it hits the open air. So the cop says to you, empty your pockets. You empty your pockets, and on the advice of a cop, you end up manifesting a crime. So these elements of injustice are present in states and cities across the country. I see them as kind of low-hanging fruit that we can one by one start to impact and mitigate to make the country much fairer. Then we can take stock more broadly of whether, like Portugal, we want to move to a more sane system that has to do with a measure of decriminalization. Careful steps. They don't need to freak anybody out and make a loud, silly argument out of anything. We have support for ending the war on drugs from voices from George Shultz, James Baker, Pat Robertson, all the way over on the opposite side of the aisle. You find people on both sides of the political spectrum now recognize this thing is incredibly costly, has cost over $1 trillion in the last 40 years, had 45 million arrests. It has not made drugs cheaper. It has not done anything except make drugs cheaper, more available, made it so younger and younger kids are able to sell them and willing to sell them and involved in them. So it's failed on all fronts and cost a fortune, and everyone can agree that in tight budget times like this, we need to pull back on those areas. The initiative that's slated for being on the ballot in November, for example, is promised to save the California at minimum $100 million a year. Just that one small couple of sentences on a ballot.
Well, just in closing, Eugene Jarecki, the film also, I think, makes a very strong case that the punishment for nonviolent crime in the form of drug use and drug dealing, although there are obviously there's crime associated with it, and a number of the people you profile in prison have committed murders, etc. The long and the short of it is, though, the punishment doesn't end. I mean, these people, when they finally get out after these draconian sentences, 40 sure. years, they can't get a job and they can't vote. And that's the way the system is being built. But what feeds the system on the other side, and on the profit side, as opposed to the loss side in terms of human loss, is, of course, the forfeiture laws, where police departments have incentives to seize money and cars, etc., yes. and get promotions and get overtime and all this stuff. That's the part of it that I find extraordinary.
Look at it this way. My film goes into some detail into how the prison industrial system works and the way in which it warps public policy and the way in which it has created a generation of politicians who pander to the public, trying to get elected and stay in power by promising to be tough on crime. But being tough on crime doesn't necessarily mean you're being smart on crime. And the real question is, what is the way you fight something like the scourge of drugs in our society, the degree to which Americans take drugs, and they do take drugs a great deal, and in many cases, drugs can hurt the people who take them. In some cases, they don't. I don't use drugs, but I know people who use drugs and don't destroy their lives, and I know a lot of people who've taken drugs and really damaged their lives. That's what's called a public health conversation. That public health conversation was hijacked by politicians and ultimately their bedfellows in the prison industrial and sort of criminal justice sector where there is profit to be made. And unfortunately, a runaway system like that Eisenhower warned us about with war has run away from us. And it's no surprise that we call it a drug war because it has all the features of the kinds of corruption that sort of spring up around war. They're like weeds. And what you find is that for every prison, you have people providing food service, people providing phone service, people who have jobs based on it, whole communities that come to rely on this. And no one is after their jobs. I don't want people who work in the prison system or people who work in the criminal justice system broadly to have the rug taken out from under their feet. Nothing of the kind. What I would like to do is to see all of those people have their energies turned to something productive for this country. You cannot sell any product out of the prison industrial system that isn't cannibalizing itself. That's not something the rest of the world can buy. They can't buy the misery of a prisoner. They can't buy his recidivism. They can't buy that the family is left at home shattered and orphaned and the rest and spiraling into repetitions of the same cycle. You've got to have so all this imagination and all these extraordinary people who I've met who work in our criminal justice system, they deserve better. They deserve a much better way of life than that provided to them in an industry that preys on others. It just isn't, it's not American, it's not decent. It's why we must with embarrassment say that we're the world's leading incarcerator. And I raise all this because I believe there is serious capacity for reform right now happening all around us, and we can all be part of it. And we have to understand that this is sort of a shift to that better country we all imagined with a million green jobs and making the products of tomorrow, not sort of cannibalizing ourselves to suck whatever last monies we have left that we haven't blown at some casino that's doing the same. You know, it's not a direction for a country. And so the question is, how do you look at this in common sense terms and say, look, it's failed. We've got to do it a different way. What are the models around the world that people are trying? How are they doing? No one has the answer. So the question is, what can we put together as a grouping of better methods? I met with someone from the DA's office in New York City last week, and I'm very proud that the DA of L.A., Steve Cooley, is going to be appearing with me this Friday at the screening of the film here at the L.A. Film Festival, because what I'm seeing increasingly from those at the higher levels of the criminal justice field is deep thinkers, people who really care about society and who don't just fill some stereotype of lock them up and throw away the key. I found that consistently in my travels around the criminal justice system. And when you meet someone like Steve Cooley, who's a remarkable public servant, who really is wrapping his head, for example, around this Three Strikes initiative and recognizes that the Three Strikes change will save the state $100 million at minimum a year and recognizes that it's also just good law enforcement, common sense, and happens to be decent. You find this all over the place. I had this in New York City, where people from the DA's office in New York came to my screening this past week, and they were there to talk about the problems of stop and frisk and how unfair it is and that there must be a better way. And one of the things that one of the members of the DA's office said is, why don't we incentivize innovation in this? Why don't we put out a prize that encourages people to come up with better ways of dealing with what is ultimately a public health problem and not a criminal justice opportunity?
Well, Eugene Jurecki, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Eugene Jurecki, who's the award-winning director of a number of feature documentaries, including Reagan, Freakonomics, Why We Fight, The Trials of Henry Kissinger, and his latest film, The House I Live In. It opens nationwide in October, and it premieres at the Los Angeles Film Festival on Friday. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.